Pat Summerall has one of the most familiar voices and faces in sports broadcasting history. He's worked as an announcer for over 40 years, covering football, tennis, and golf for CBS and Fox. And before that, he was a successful pro football place kicker for the New York Giants. He's written an autobiography called Summerall On and Off the Air, in which he describes his sports career, his lifelong battle with alcoholism, and his recent spiritual rebirth. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. By the way, the book is published by Nelson. And I was surprised that the first pages of your book weren't about football or broadcasting. You instead talk about being an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Do you feel your struggle with alcoholism has tainted your achievements in broadcasting and football?
Oh, I don't know. I think the way that people regard the disease probably to some people might have. But I think the fact that I've been able to overcome it certainly is something that I wanted to share with people and let them know that it can be beaten, and I'm one of those who've beaten it.
Didn't you help Mickey Mantle conquer his alcohol problems at the end of his life?
Yes, I did. Mickey and I became very good friends. Well, we actually met each other when he was in his teens and I was in my teens. We were playing minor league baseball. That was the beginning of our friendship. Then during his time with the Yankees, my time here in New York with the Giants, we got to be closer friends. And then I moved to Dallas, and he moved to Dallas after he retired. And we became golfing buddies and drinking buddies and very, very good friends.
So how many sports did you play? You were a minor league baseball player. What position did you play?
I was a first baseman.
And then you were just a place kicker? Well, when you were in college, you played on both offense and defense.
Right.
That's the way the
game
was played.
In the National Football League, I played full-time defensive end for the Cardinals. Before I was traded to the Giants, and I was a tight end, a tight end and a place kicker with the Giants. In those days, the specialty days were not on us yet. They had a player limit of 33, so you couldn't afford a specialist, a kicker or a punter or anything like that. So you had to play as well as kick.
And now they have more coaches on teams than they used to have players in those days.
Yeah, we had five assistants when I was with the Giants.
Yeah, but now, I don't know.
They have 19, most of them.
Wow. Do you think that has changed the sport? You've seen, over your career, you have seen football change so much. You've seen pro football go from being a kind of second-rate sport to being perhaps the most popular one in America.
Well, I never thought it was a second-rate sport because that was what I was playing. But yes, it's changed so much. The game itself, the tackling, the basics of the game hasn't changed very much. The equipment has changed and improved to such a degree that you're much more mobile now. The players are bigger and faster. That's changed, but the game itself hasn't changed that much.
I mean, the strategies haven't gotten all that much
strategies
more complicated?
Strategies are not that much different. You have a specialist where you used to have somebody playing, let's say, a wide receiver who might be fatigued. Now, all he has to do is hold his hand up and somebody replaces him.
But also you had in those days 240-pound defensive linemen.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody on the offensive line who was close to 300 pounds was considered very overweight. Today,
fat.
Yeah. Today, 300-pound is normal.
You can't play in the offensive line today unless you're over 300. Really. There are very few.
So do you think that the great players, and you played with some of the greatest of all time,
yeah.
Do you think that they could have made it today, or would they have just beefed up so much more that they would have looked different than they did?
Some of the players that I played with were gifted enough to play today. The diets are better. The coaching is better. The equipment is so much lighter. So it's hard to compare eras.
Well, like even kicking, you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nowadays, people are soccer kickers, and
it's a
you
totally
are
different motion from what it used to be.
You kicked it with
the
front toe, like
yeah.
Lou Groza and
right.
all the other greats of that time.
Right.
So,
right.
Would you have been a better kicker? Do you think if you had known about the soccer stuff?
Oh, I think so. In fact, after I retired and playing in the front yard with my kids and what have you, I tried it soccer style, and yes, I would have been much better had I been a soccer style kicker.
Were you drinking throughout your playing career?
Not much. Just an occasional beer or, some time with teammates or something like that. Not much.
So when did it change for you?
I think when I got into the broadcasting business and had to entertain clients. I'm not blaming the broadcasting business, but that was when I started a serious undertaking of a drink. And one thing led to another. At lunch, and then after work, and then on the weekends. And as I started to do golf and tennis and places where there were a lot of drinks available, I took advantage of those things.
And there's a lot of hard drinking in, or was, I don't know if it's still the case, in broadcasting.
Well, after
it used to
hours,
be in the newspaper business as well.
I'm sure. But yeah, there were a lot of idle hours when you were in strange cities and strange places and didn't know anybody, and so you spent your time at the bar trying to entertain yourself. And that's sort of how it became habitual.
Did it affect your job performance?
I didn't think it did. I'm sure it did, but I didn't think it did. And at that time particularly.
Charlie Parker, the great jazz man, who had serious problems with drugs and alcohol, said that he always thought that he was playing better when he was high. And then he listened to some old records when he had kick drugs for a time.
Mm-hmm.
He went back, unfortunately. And he said he could hear that he wasn't playing very well at all.
Well, the thing about it is, I think that you think it's not affecting you. You think you can handle it. You think that it's not going to affect your performance. I know it affected the way I prepared and the time that I spent preparing for a broadcast. I know that for a fact because I just didn't feel like doing those things. But as far as performance on the air, I don't think I didn't think at that time I was ever affected.
And were any of your colleagues concerned ever?
No.
They probably were drinking as much as you were.
Not as much, or not as often. But no, nobody ever said anything to me.
My guest is Pat Summerall. His book, Summerall On and Off the Air, is published by Nelson Books, which is a division of Thomas Nelson Publishers. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you see any similarities between alcohol abuse and drug abuse with athletes? Because one is intended to enhance performance, and the other obviously has a negative effect on performance.
When I was in recovery at the Betty Ford Center, about half of the so-called inmates, is what I called them, including me, were there for drug abuse. And alcohol is a drug, after all. It's a foreign substance you put in your body. And there were similarities. The cures are similar. The remedies are similar. Some successful, some not. Thank goodness mine was.
Well, steroids are another kind of drug abuse that we're talking
performance
about.
Performance enhancing, yes. Yeah. I don't know about steroids.
Well, they weren't around when
no,
you were playing.
I suspect that
players would have taken them because there's always that desire by players to get that little extra edge.
Well, if the guy playing across from you, you know, is taking advantage of steroids, it makes him more able to work out longer, more tolerant of pain. If he's doing it, then I have to do it. That's the way they approach, because if I'm going to play against you and I'm going to beat you, I've got to be just as strong and just as quick as you are.
When you were broadcasting, did you become aware of these sorts of changes in sports?
There were some times that I thought, particularly during the NBA, that there were some people who were not performing as well as they should, and they thought they were. I don't know if it was steroids or what it was, but I thought that there's something wrong. We're not getting the best out of these guys. I was aware that something was going on. I don't know what it was. I didn't know what it was.
What led you to decide to enter the Betty Ford Clinic?
There was an intervention led by one of my former working partners. A group of people got together, confronted me with the things that they had seen me do, and they were frankly afraid that I was killing myself. Because I wasn't taking care of myself physically. I had become far less patient. My morals had deteriorated. My personal standards had deteriorated.
And they were on a short fuse, you say?
Yeah,
also.
And they got together, and we had a meeting in Camden, New Jersey, as a matter of fact. 14 people that I respected and was afraid of in some cases, some of my bosses, and they wrote letters and read them to me about things that they had seen me do, and they thought that I should go for some counseling, go somewhere for some help. My daughter's letter is the thing that really turned the intervention around when she said lately, in social situations, I'm sorry we have the same last name. And I thought, my gosh, if that's the case of my own family, I better do something about it.
And you hadn't been all that aware of this as a problem?
Oh, I think every person who fights that disease is aware. They think, as I thought, that I can quit any time I want to. I can stop whenever I feel like it. I just don't want to. And I had said to myself a number of times, well, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm not going to do it anymore. But I always did it. If they hadn't confronted me, I probably would not have gone for help. And I'm so glad that they did.
And when was that? What year?
1992, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then you also found God.
That was part of the recovery, the realization that somebody was talking to my conscience and telling me the difference between right and wrong, and I wasn't really sure who that was. And then I discovered there was a higher power. There was somebody talking to my conscience. There was somebody helping me make the right choice. And then as I read the Bible, there were two books we could read. One was the Alcoholics Anonymous Bible, and the other was the Holy Bible. And I got tired of reading about stories about people doing the same things that I had done, so I started to read the Bible. And there were a lot of questions, and there were a lot of answers, too.
So you had yourself baptized for a second time.
Right, right.
Do you now see part of your mission to spread Christianity?
Yeah, I had a liver transplant. I had surgery for a liver transplant 2 years ago. And while I was waiting for the liver transplant, the question came to my mind, why am I getting another chance at life? Because I've lived a good life. I've had a great life. I've done a lot of things. I've accomplished a lot of things. Why does somebody have to die for me to live? Why am I getting another chance? And there were two friends of mine who happened to be pastors standing at the foot of my bed when I was at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. And I posed that question to them. I asked them, why do you think I'm getting another chance at life? And almost in unison, as if they had practiced, they said, because God's not through with you yet. There's a lot more work God has for you to do. And I thought about that, and that sort of stunk in, and then I kept getting more and more impatient about, if God has something for me to do, when's he going to tell me, and when am I going to start? And over the years since that operation, I think he has told me what to do. Things like write this book, things like appear at meetings and AA meetings, for example, and church meetings, and to spread just what happened to me. That's my job. That's my assignment, I think.
So if you had a colleague who still had an alcohol problem, and you told him what you think he should do,
right?
Do you think he would have reacted the same way? He would react the same way you might have 15 or 20 years ago?
I have no way of knowing. I've had friends who've gone as a result of association with me, and I feel like that's part of God's assignment, to be able to help people like that. And I've had a number of people ask me, what was it like at the Betty Ford's, and Mickey Mantle is one of them. What was it like, and what did you learn, and what's treatment all about? Did you have any fun? To which I said, no, you're not going to have fun. You're going to get well.
Well, I remember talking to Mickey's widow and one of his sons. How many sons does he have?
He had four. Two of them have passed away.
I had one of his sons here, and they talked about how difficult he was to live with for many of the years when the
right.
alcohol was really bad.
Right.
And you have had the same problem with your family.
Well, because of our association, Mickey was such a good friend, he went to the Betty Ford Center, and for the last 18 months that he lived, he didn't touch any whiskey or any kind of alcohol.
My guest is Pat Summerall. He's written a book called Summerall On and Off the Air. It is published by Nelson Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Pat Summerall, who has written a kind of a memoir, kind of a self-help book. It's called On and Off the Air, and it's published by Nelson Books. You played in the 1958 championship game against the Baltimore Colts
right.
when you were with the Giants,
right.
a game many people think is the best in history. What do you think? You've been in the broadcast booth for many years. How would you rank that game, that 1958 game?
Well, as you said, a lot of people say it was the best game, the greatest game ever played. I don't think it was the greatest game ever played by any means. It was the first to go into overtime. That's what made it, I think, so famous. We the Giants had a tough road to get into the championship game. The Colts had, in the meantime, clinched their division before the season was over, so they had two or three weeks to rest. We were tired. We were fatigued, and I thought that we were lucky, number one, to be in the game, number two, for it to be as close as it was. So I don't think technically, as you look at football games, and this was great and that was great, the drive that won the game for the Colts that was conducted by John Unitas and Raymond Berry was probably one of the greatest drives that's ever been put together in the history of football. But the game itself was rather sloppy, I thought. Certainly not the greatest game ever played. I mean, although I was a part of it.
Perhaps because it was just so exciting. And well, also because it was New York, don't you think? It was different playing in New York, wasn't it?
Pardon?
Wasn't it different playing in New York?
Oh, sure. We the Giants, had become over the course of that year sort of the darlings of New York. It was a discovery of that period of time how good and how entertaining pro football could be. Every game was a sellout. That game in particular brought the interest not only of New York but of the country to what a great game pro football is.
Mm-hmm. In those days, I guess football players started looking like larger than life characters.
Yeah.
Charlie Connolly, Sam Huff.
Right. Both teammates.
Yeah. Wyatt Tittle wasn't with the team yet.
Yes, he was. Not that year, but he came 2 years later.
And, of course, Johnny Unitas, as you said.
Unitas was the conductor of the Colts offense.
So how old were you when you decided to retire from football?
I was 31.
Very young.
Right. I could have played as a kicker. I could have probably played another 7 or 8 years. I had two kids. We were living in a hotel in the Bronx. It wasn't a very good life. Nobody made that much money. I had an opportunity to go to work for CBS, and I took advantage of that. And it was what turned out to be a special life. But I just had enough of being sore on Thursday and Friday from the previous week, and I'd had enough of the train. I was living in Florida at the time, and we moved to a New York hotel. It wasn't the most glamorous life in the world that it seemed to be. So I just had enough of it.
Today, of course, you would have made enough money to have stayed for the next 10 years.
Oh, I would have stayed, and I would have made enough money to set myself for the rest of life.
Now, why did CBS want you to work as a broadcaster?
Well, I really don't know, but I'm so glad they did.
I mean, had you thought of becoming a broadcaster after you retired?
No, we had played a preseason game. We, the Giants, had played a preseason game in Newark, played the Packers in Newark, and we were training at Bear Mountain, and we had 3 or 4 days before we had to be back at Bear Mountain in training camp, and I happened to be in a hotel with my roommate, who was Charlie Connolly, the quarterback, and the telephone rang. I was lying on the bed watching television. Telephone rang, and I answered the phone, and Charlie was in the shower. And this voice, I had no idea who it was, said, could he speak to Charlie? And I said, he's in the shower. I'll give him a message. So this gentleman said, remind him that he's supposed to be at CBS this afternoon at 4 o'clock to read an audition script for a 5-minute radio show. And I said, I'll be glad to tell him. And I was about an inch from hanging up the phone, and I heard him say something else. I couldn't make out what it was, but I put the phone back to my ear, and he said, what are you doing this afternoon? And I said, I don't know. I'm going off with the guys somewhere. He said, why don't you come along and read the script along with Charlie and two more teammates. There are going to be three of you, now four, to read the same script. So I went, and they liked the way I read and the way I sounded, and so they hired me.
But, you know, that there's one thing reading the script. There's another thing doing play-by-play of a football game. I remember when Marty Glickman talked about how he would work for long, long hours with former football players to teach them how to do the basics of calling a game.
Well, I had some great teachers in the beginning. When I first started, I started on radio, which is a great education. You learn how to read.
Radio is still the best, I have to tell you that.
Yeah, I think so. But then when I started to work doing Giant Games, I worked with Chris Schenkel, who was a great instructor and a good teacher, taught me about a lot about preparation and how to go about preparing. Then after Chris left and went to another network, they put me with Jack Buck, who was a legend. And Jack and I spent 4 or 5 years together. I was the analyst. He was the play-by-play man. And then they sent me to work with Ray Scott, who was one of the best, I think, ever. And I learned a lot, absorbed a lot from Ray Scott about broadcasting, about how to conduct and do play-by-play.
And then you have to learn how to do interviews as
well. Oh, sure, sure. Well, Art Linkletter was a great help to me when I was at CBS about doing interviews, about interviewing children. He said, you have to listen to what the children say because you never know what they're going to say. And if you're not listening, they'll lead you somewhere where you never thought you'd go. So he was a great help to me. Then in the middle of the year, I was back after Ray Scott left. I was working back again with Jack Buck, and the boss at CBS called me into his office and said, I got to split you and Jack Buck up because you sound too much alike, and I can't tell who's talking. So I said in the middle of the year, if you're going to split us up, if that's what you want to do, I think I'd like to try to do play-by-play. And I thought they'd wait 6 months or so and let me practice and warm up. He said, well, if we're going to do it, let's do it next week. So in the middle of the season, I started to do play-by-play.
And was it easy to move
into? Well, because I had had such great teachers and because I was comfortable and because I knew how to prepare, I worked with Tom Brookshire the next week, and we were successful.
Was the early transition difficult? There must have been times when you thought, gee, I'd like to go out there on the field again, or I wish I were coaching.
I thought about coaching, and I did coach the Rams for 2 weeks, and I decided after 2 weeks that's not what I wanted to do. I had already started to do some broadcasting, and I thought that's the direction that I wanted to go in, but I had to get coaching out of my system, which I did very quickly.
And then you wound up working some of the most historic broadcasts.
Right.
You worked the first Super Bowl game, right, didn't you?
Yep.
And you were in at the start of Monday Night Football.
I did not do Monday Night Football.
Well, didn't you do interviews before and after?
No. Oh. I never worked for ABC, and they had Monday Night Football. So.
Oh, well.
I was not a part of that.
But working the first Super Bowl, did you have any sense that this was going to be something momentous? Because football had gone through an earlier realignment when teams like the Cleveland Browns and Los Angeles Rams.
Not alone. I knew that the Super Bowl was a game that the Packers, who were in the first Super Bowl, I knew Vince Lombardi. I had played for him with the Giants. I knew that the Packers did not even want to play in the Super Bowl. They thought they had won the championship of the most important league the week before, so they didn't want to go to Los Angeles. The Kansas City Chiefs, their opponent, did very much want to play in the game for respectability as far as the AFL was concerned. But nobody thought it was going to be a contest. There were 40,000 empty seats in the Los Angeles Coliseum. The tickets were $12 a piece. It was sort of an afterthought. So nobody thought, including me and the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, or no one thought that the game would reach the magnitude that it's reached.
Well, it only changed when the Jets won the Super Bowl against the Colts, again, a New York team against the Colts, and suddenly the AFC had respectability.
Respectability, right.
Because
right.
They had been pretty much wiped out.
You could see that the game was going to be something special by that time that was a little bit more special than people had originally thought, because as I said, it was not even a sellout, the first one.
You worked with Tom Brookshire, who is another great broadcaster. John Madden as well?
22 years with John Madden, 8 with Brookshire.
Now John Madden was doing color commentary. You had done color commentary before. You probably knew as much about what was going on as he did. I don't mean in any way to disparage John Madden, who is truly a great broadcaster.
Yes. I don't know that I knew as much about the technicalities of playing in the offensive line as John does and did. But he had that ability that he has still today to articulate something in a very limited amount of time, which you have very small amount of time as an analyst to make whatever point you want to make. I knew pretty quickly after we started to work together that we were going to fit. Because unlike other situations and other announcers I had worked with, where you had hand signals, or I'd tap him on the leg when I was through talking, or he would give me an indication that he wanted to talk. John and I never had any kind of signal. He just knew when I was through talking. I knew when he was through talking, and we just fit together. We never interrupted each other. And I don't know why or how that magic comes together, but it did.
Well, I guess when you were with Tom Brookshire, but also with Madden, you were also drinking heavily. You say it was a lot of fun.
Not with Madden, no.
Only with Brookshire?
Right.
You were at the height of your drinking. You say also the height of your fun as an announcer.
Right.
Did you think that they went together, or is it just coincidental?
Well, I knew that Tom knew the game. I knew that I knew the game. I knew that we were comfortable with our relationship, and we had a good time off the field, out of the booth, as well as in the booth.
And I'm sure both of you hoped to be nominated for Academy Awards at one point.
Well, I don't remember having those thoughts, but that's a good one.
You appeared in a film together?
Yes, two films.
Ah, because you represented broadcasting to most Americans,
well,
football broadcasting.
John Frankenheimer, who produced Black Sunday, heard us work one of the Super Bowls and said, these are the two guys I want to make my announcers as part of my movie. So Tom and I did Black Sunday, and then John and I did a movie not too long ago called The Replacements. But, yeah, we enjoyed those times.
How did you wind up covering other sports? Were you,
well, I
you played golf.
Sports. I played golf. I played basketball in college and in high school. I played baseball, obviously. And in order to get out of the football shell, so to speak, I asked the bosses at CBS if I could do golf. And after they tried me a couple of golf tournaments, then I started to cover it on a weekly basis. Same is true. I played tennis when I was growing up, and so I covered the U.S. Open for 28 years here in New York, and did the French Open many times, did 2 years of the NBA. So it was just a desire on my part to do other sports as well as football.
My guest is Pat Summerall. He's written a book called Summerall, On and Off the Air. It's published by Nelson. Well, today we don't see as much of that, of broadcasters covering a lot of different sports. It seems to be
well,
more
special. Well, Jim Nantz does football and golf particularly. There are some people who do it, but the seasons at that time didn't overlap as they do now. Each season has gotten longer as they try to generate more funds and more money. So it's hard to do, let's say, basketball and football at the same time. There are people who do it, but not in the way that I did it, because the seasons overlap and you just can't do both.
What other ways has the broadcasting business changed over the years?
Oh, I think when I started, there was no instant replay. That's been a big change. The mobility of the equipment. You had a stationary camera when I first started to do television. You had maybe five cameras. And they couldn't move. They just couldn't. They were too heavy. Now it's become much more mobile. The statistical part of the way you keep up with what's going on the field has become so much more sophisticated.
In fact, after a complicated play, we
right.
get to see six or seven camera angles.
Right.
Because sometimes you can't tell what happened by just looking at one shot.
Well, the officials replay. If the coach challenges what happened and they replay it and replay it and replay it, then those facilities and those kind of things didn't happen when I started in the business. I think the mobility and the technical improvements have changed much more than the broadcasting of the event itself.
But it's also made it a lot more expensive.
Right.
And now ABC Sports, once one of the proudest sports broadcasting entities possible, is it no longer
exists.
Yeah. So is it because it's just so expensive to do sports?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons ABC got out of the business is because they were losing money on the amount of money that they had to spend for the rights to the NFL. And the last 5 or 6 years particularly, the ratings have been going down and the amount that they can charge the advertisers has decreased. So it was time to get out.
You no longer are doing network broadcasting.
Right.
You're covering the Cowboys?
Some of their pregame shows and some inserts during halftime and things like that.
Would you want to be doing back?
If somebody asked me, I'm happy with my life, but if somebody asked me to go back and broadcast, I think I would do it.
What happened? I mean, you obviously still know the game.
Well, I think one thing that happened is I had had a liver transplant. Mm-hmm. And so I was out.
That kept you out for a while.
Kept me out. My health started to deteriorate. So I just wasn't available. Now my health is good, and I'm ready to go back. But I haven't been asked yet.
The Cowboys are a good fit because you've known Bill Parcells for a while.
Right, and I live there.
You live in Dallas.
Yeah.
What happens after a liver transplant? Do you have to make adjustments in your life?
Well, I still have to take a lot of medicine.
To keep your body from rejecting
anti-rejection medicines and other things that happen during the transplant. My stamina is not quite what it was yet, but it's pretty doggone good. And I feel good. It's amazing how successful the operation was. I know in every case they don't have that degree of success that I have. But I feel terrific.
And you have become a speaker for organ transplants.
And God is working, got some jobs for me to do, too.
Does it feel odd suddenly being so open about your life after all these years of being somebody who people only knew as that face in the broadcast booth?
I guess it does. the most difficult person, I think, to be honest with is yourself. And I think in being honest with yourself, it's sort of a gratifying feeling to say, hey, everything that's in that book is the truth. Everything I say is the truth. The only thing I got better at when I was drinking was lying. And I'm not very proud of that. But now life is so much more simple, and everything has turned out to be just 100% better.
And I'm sure your daughter is a lot happier.
Yeah, we're much closer.
So I understand that thing about lying. Once you start getting caught up in lies,
right,
then it gets more and more complicated. It snowballs.
Right.
And so you've just simplified your life these days.
Well, if everything's the truth, you don't have to worry about what you said.
What about all your former colleagues, whether the former players and mm-hmm. the other broadcasters? Have you gotten any feedback from them?
Well, the book just comes out today, so no, I haven't gotten any feedback. But one of the things I waited so long to write a book for, one of the reasons I waited so long, was I wanted to wait until I had something of a positive nature to say. I didn't want to embarrass myself or any of my former working partners or anybody that I played football with or played golf with or anybody else. I wanted to wait until I felt I had something to say that might help somebody.
And Pat Summerall has told the story of being a place kicker for the legendary New York Giants in the late 50s and 60s, and then becoming a mainstay of CBS Sports Broadcasting for 32 years, covering football, also golf, including the Masters, the U.S. Open Tennis Championship, the NBA, 5 heavyweight championship fights. At the same time, he also served as host of CBS's 4-hour news program that aired 6 mornings a week. He's written a book called Summerall, On and Off the Air, and it is published by Nelson Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a joy.